Hello neighbours, welcome to Fit to Eat, the Newfoundland Labrador Farm and Food Show. I'm Ivan Hemke, your host. This is episode 4 of season 2. Today we go to town to visit a farm, one that's about 200 years old as a space for growing food. O'Brien's Farm on Oxen Pond Road in St. John's has been operating in one way or another since about 1818. This despite a city growing up around it, and despite the neighbouring pig barns and vegetable patches somehow transforming into the Avalon Mall.
I love agriculture because in a weird way, it's like somewhat subversive in this day and age. So we are in the beginning phases of developing an incubator farm. The global food system has created a situation in which there's just an overwhelming amount of information, and it's just really hard for us to synthesize it. I thought I would go sell orange juice futures on the Chicago futures market or something like that. And then we had kids.
Today, I talk with the farm manager of the O'Brien Farm Foundation, on site in Thimble Cottage, a saltbox dwelling from the 1850s. By the way, we're sometimes surrounded by the happy voices of the students at the Cloudberry Forest School who use the facility. Instead of agriculture in the classroom, they have agriculture as the classroom. It's midwinter, pre-pandemic. We talk about our guest's trajectory to this place, from a winery in California to an agricultural extension agent in Senegal to the director of an agricultural museum in Mississippi to a hill overlooking the Freshwater Valley in St. John's. Pull up one of those old antique chairs and join us, but sit on it gently.
My name is Aaron Rogers, and we are at O'Brien Farm.
What's O'Brien Farm?
O'Brien Farm is a 200-year-old dairy farm founded through the second wave Irish immigration. It was actually squatted on prior to legally being part of the farm.
Before the agricultural land lease program started.
Exactly. You could squat, right? Yeah, so it was 1818.
1818,
is okay. When the O'Brien family originally started farming some of this area, and have over the last 200 years. It's been a dairy farm, a small vegetable farm. They've had hay, various forages that they've sold. A wide variety, kind of trying out different ideas. And it kind of ended with these three brothers, the O'Brien brothers, that were fairly well known in the St. John's community. And especially Ali O'Brien, who taught Gaelic. Kind of a gentleman scholar, gentleman farmer, yeah. He worked at the botanical gardens, and they lived here, and they didn't really have heat or running water or any of that kind of stuff here on the site. So they lived in this cottage, the three of them, and they worked the land, and they had separate jobs in town, but, you know, bring vegetables in, they would bring cream in, they sold milk in town, they delivered milk. You know, it was like a very subsistency type lifestyle.
When did that stop?
Somewhere in the 70s.
Okay, so it's relatively recently.
Yes, much so. But they still tried to maintain as much as they could out here. And there's some really interesting stories. Like at one point, I believe there was like a lease, kind of sublease some areas too. Mm-hmm. So there was a Chinese grocery in town, and one of the members of the family that ran the grocery would come up here and farm some bok choy and Chinese cabbages. And exactly. The O'Briens, especially the brothers, the three brothers that lived here, were adamant that this was going to maintain a farm and that they were going to keep the property as agricultural land. You could just imagine. It's a beautiful piece of property.
Oh, yeah.
It's right on the edge of the Freshwater Valley, and it looks out over things. But they refused to sell. They also informally did a lot of stuff to really prevent crowding. And so there are old stories of homemade booby traps and things out here to keep the kids from eating the apples. And they were kind of notorious for being like kind of grumpy, like sweet but grumpy. And then the other thing is, I think they did everything in their power to keep it in production for as long as they could unto their deaths. I mean, they were working into their 80s. All of them were working as best they could well into their later years.
And when did they die?
John died in 98 and Michael in 2005 and Allie in 2008.
So what is the place now?
One of the beauties of what they did, and especially Allie, who was the last remaining family member, is that he really wanted to continue the legacy of what this was past his life. And so he basically managed to write a will that kept it as agricultural land. So we are within the boundaries of Pippi Park. This property itself is crown land, but it's all done in a way in which it stays this. It's not going to be sectioned out out over time and things like that. Yeah. And then shortly after his passing, a foundation was set up to try and determine what this should be. So we are in the beginning phases of developing an incubator farm. What we've realized is that there are a lot of barriers to entry for small, medium-sized farmers and certainly first-generation farmers here in Newfoundland. And that is a North America-wide problem. There are grants and all out there. I mean, there are a lot of opportunities. There is some money available. But in terms of actually being able to find property and places where you can test out your actual business sense and trying to understand the science on a larger scale than your backyard, it's really, really hard to find. Yeah. So that's one of the legs of our three-legged chair, what we're building out here.
As a young person interested in farming, I'd come to you and I could rent space from you and advice, and I'd have a community of other people who are doing the same.
Yep. And then we share a lot of our capital expenses. So we're in the beginning stages of building out that program.
I mean, that's something that's a priority in the province.
Yes.
So is it possible to get some support for that kind of thing?
We do. We have got financial support, both public and private. And then along with that, it will allow us for a lot of educational programming. It's funny. So it's a center of education, and yet it's not an education center.
Right, okay.
We're not an ag college.
No.
There are some
They're
wonderful ag colleges in Canada. But if I wanted to start a farm, I still think that having a place where I could do that in a scalable way would be more beneficial than trying to walk into a bank or government office and say, hey, I need 50 acres. And on top of that, I need like $1 million. So what we're trying to do is develop a way for peer-to-peer education to bring in experts to help with some of the issues that people may find, and then let people experiment on their own and work together and cooperate for the whole production cycle. And when I say production cycle, not just putting plants in the ground and getting something out of it at the end. At the end of the day, you need to be able to take what you have and exchange it for something else.
Exchange it
for money so you can take your cut, go ahead and feed your family. That being said, we don't plan on having formal instructors. So many great ideas through the dawn of time have been born out of people being told that that wouldn't work. It's more a process of let's just make sure that you've thought about the very end cycle of the market. So from the very beginning to the very end.
Yeah.
So many farmers fall into that trap. They are great scientists. They can get from point A to point B. The hard part that so many of them have is getting from point B to point C. And point C is selling their product, getting it to where it needs to be at the price in which they can recoup their expenses and then pay for life,
They can get back to point A again.
To get back to point A. And hopefully, I mean, at the end of the day, you know, have some leftover in your pocket so you can take, you know, a family vacation.
Are you at the point where people are waiting for this opportunity to open? Like, do you know people already who are interested?
I think that there is a groundswell of support, I think, especially in the younger community. Again, there's a lot of barriers to entry. There's also a lot of people that are looking for a second career.
So you're looking at some second career farmers possibly as well?
Oh, definitely. I think we'll find a lot of folks that are in that point in their life. I think, again, kind of the beauty of what we're developing out here is it gives people a way to do this where they can either try and start a small business, but also those people that may be considering the second career and they've scaled up their backyard enough and they've realized how much enjoyment they get out of that and how little enjoyment they get out of their first career and give them the opportunity to say, okay, like if you want to, again, transition, this is a great place to try that. And then let's take some time to work through the whole process and get to do it with like-minded people.
Give us a piece of music that I should use here and there.
I actually thought of some West African music, a musician that is world famous, but has also, when you listen to his music, you realize like how much influence the West African music had on American blues music. Ali Farka Touré, I mean, just an amazing musician. There's a song called Erdi.
Bismillah. العالمين برضه هي سنة شعب ما يفوها مقاقا لسما يعقونا سنة أحمد والله شكرا بريد
That's Ali Farka Touré with Erdi, played by request of today's guest, Aaron Rogers. We head back to Thimble Cottage at the O'Brien Farm.
Seems like it's stool.
Yes.
One leg is the incubator farm.
Yes, certainly educational programming. So we are building a learning center. It'll be just a wonderful place where you will be able to have demonstrators, instructors, mm-hmm. and things like that come mm-hmm. in. We're already meeting with a lot of potential partners in the community, mm-hmm. people that want to do things, mm-hmm. like cooking classes, yeah. you know, educational activities, and it can be a wide range.
The botanical garden is very close. Are you,
yes.
do you share a boundary?
We do, yes. And yeah. again, like, just it's the beauty of the site here. You realize that there are a lot of really important niche opportunities out there. There's stuff that they're doing over there and what they've already developed and all the infrastructure that they have and all the knowledge base yeah, they have. Yeah. But there are things that they aren't necessarily set up to do that we can do.
So you would become a destination for school groups and whatever.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
And then that third piece, which is, you know, here being in a 150-year-old cottage
yeah.
and on a 200-year-old farm, is being able to be an education center for that Irish Newfoundland history. Talking about right. that second wave right. Irish immigration that happened specific to the city of St. John's, yeah. saying, okay, this is obviously like a city where people want to live. We got to figure out a way to grow our own food.
Right.
right. to be a site like this, to have 30 acres, it's kind of relatively untouched with some neat historical buildings and a fantastic story. It really allows us to broaden what we think we can offer.
So tell me a bit about how you got here and your background.
Yeah.
You have a background in agriculture too.
I do.
Knowing more about that.
So yeah, I've only lived out here for about 6 months now.
Welcome.
Thank you.
People tried to screech you in or something?
Oh, a long time ago.
Yeah,
yeah.
I forget that. It was created for tourists. Yeah, not a tourist. I'm living here.
That's right. So I'm from California. My dad grows wine grapes for a living. So I grew up in a small agricultural town and then got to the point where I said, this is terrible and I want to get out and I never want to deal with agriculture again. Like a lot of people.
Yeah, that phase.
And then slowly, you know, go to university and you travel the world. And I was really lucky to be able to go experience a lot of different things, a lot of different cultures. And you realize that agriculture is not the problem. The problem was the small town. And the fact that you're an adolescent, you just want to get out and go do things. You realize that agriculture is one of the best ways to be able to experience a natural environment as much yeah. as you possibly can.
Yeah.
And also, it allows you a sense of creativity, it allows you a sense of production. I'm one of those people, I like to accomplish things.
Yeah.
Like I like
yeah.
to just get
yeah.
things done. And so, being able to get to like see that from seed up to an actual product. So, I kind of traveled all over. I did some agricultural stuff. In that process, I met this really pretty girl who is from Newfoundland.
I see where the story's going.
Yes, yeah, so, like yeah. a lot of folks, right? And we ended up living in Mississippi for the last 10 years. I was in nursery business for a while, and I decided I wanted to go back to school and get a degree in agricultural economics, and I mm-hmm. thought I would go sell orange juice futures on the Chicago futures market yeah, 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 or something yeah, okay. like that. And then we had kids, you know, okay. like the typical story. Yeah. So I ended up this fascinating job, the executive director of an agriculture museum in Jackson, Mississippi. 40-acre working farm. We had the oldest operating cotton gin in the United States. You know, I mean, we were ginning cotton using 150-year-old ginning equipment.
Creating your own parts if it broke down.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. It was a great opportunity to learn about so many different aspects of agriculture, rural life, and how they all interconnected. And like a lot of Newfoundlanders, my wife just kept hearing that calling.
Right.
You know, go back to the island, go back to the island. And so she had this wonderful job opportunity, and I figured I'd come up here and, you know, maybe see what's available out there, consider starting my own farm. And if that wouldn't work out, I'd just go bartend for a little bit or something. No. Right. And then this wonderful opportunity just popped up, and people just kept sending me this link saying, hey, you got to go do this O'Brien Farm thing.
So it popped into your lap, but you popped into their laps too. You have the background in an agricultural museum, the practical, not just dusty equipment on some shelf that you look at.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it felt very serendipitous. It's been an incredibly easy transition with relation to the farm, because on the community level, there's so much interest right now in trying to solve some of these problems. And there are really, really smart people that, as far as I can tell, seem to want to work together on these things.
Yeah.
And coming from Mississippi, that wasn't the case. People silo themselves into their own ideas and what they think is going to be kind of politically big P and little p beneficial to them. And they don't venture outside of those things.
Yeah, you've come at a moment where there is a lot of groundswell of interest in food among people who are not farmers.
Yes. Well, at the end of the day, and we all want to eat three meals a day. There's 7 billion people on planet Earth. Every day, there's like 21 billion meals. If you look just purely at nutrition and calorie counts and stuff like that, there are people that generally eat 1 to 2, which is problematic. And there's people that eat 4 to 5, which is also problematic. Yeah. But it averages to about 3. Yeah. So we're making enough calories on planet Earth to provide 21 billion meals every single day. It's amazing. We're at this really amazing point in human history. We don't need to get so down on ourselves all the time. But there are outliers that we do need to think about solving. And a lot of those are local. So like a place like Newfoundland, I mean, it is that food security. If the boats stop running, like how long can we eat? Mm-hmm. And also, you know, food miles. I'm from California. I grew up in a farming family. When I go to the grocery store and your options are California strawberries, California blueberries, and California broccoli.
You must feel right at home when you go to the grocery store.
I do, but I also realize it gets 4,000 miles away. There's a level of efficiency that is, or inefficiency, really, that we're accepting, and we've built in ways to at least make it profitable for somebody. But in doing so, we're paying for it one way or another, right? Mm-hmm. Like, a lot of times we're paying for it on the back end by subsidizing all the transportation and subsidizing the way those farms are run out there and those types of places.
Yeah.
Also, there's an environmental subsidy that we're putting on it too, right? Because we are moving a product that can be grown here from 4,000 miles away. Is it easier to grow stuff in California than it is Newfoundland? Yes. But it's still 4,000 miles away. We're just paying for it in ways that we don't necessarily see at the grocery store.
Do you have a favorite Newfoundland food?
My father-in-law makes a Portuguese salt fish dish. And, he worked in fisheries for a long time. And one of his best friends was a Portuguese man. And so he taught him how to make this dish with like a salt cod, potatoes. And it's just this hearty, stick-to-your-bones dish. Yeah. It takes like a day and a half because it's soaking all the fish and all that.
Right. Yeah,
but it's like got a lot of saffron in it. Oh, it's delicious.
Yeah.
It's one of those dishes, like a good lasagna. Like, it's better the next day. Come on,
mundo. Guru tire canalho boa louco. Guru tire canalho boa louco.
By request of our guest today, that was Erdi by Ali Farkature. We begin this last section of our chat by referring to the splendid world of agricultural economics.
As an agricultural economist, it's not really a widespread skill set, let's say. Yeah. Has something struck you about the situation in Newfoundland and Labrador around food?
Agricultural economics is very specific to data collection and synthesis. So I haven't had a ton of opportunity to look specifically at data collection. Yeah. From what I've seen, the cultural, historic, social side of things, it tells a very interesting story. It tells one of there what has always been a sense of sustainability here, of self-sufficiency, because of big global economic processes and just general like evolution, right? Those kind of went away. And a lot of people get stuck on that process, right? They just say like, that was bad. And I've never been one to say that. I still like the grocery store. I like farmers markets, but I also like the grocery store. Yeah. You know, I like homemade dried fruit and I love pulling stuff out of the garden and cooking it. But I also like a bag of chips every once in a while too. Like, yeah. I do see what seems to be this new kind of venture back into the ideas of self-sustainability and self-sufficiency in terms specifically to food. And what I hope is those food decisions are going to drive some of the agriculture decisions in the future. Always like a big capitalism question, are we a demand-oriented society or are we a supply-oriented society?
Right.
And it really depends like product by product a lot of times. What I see though, and it seems to be here is that there seems to be a lot of demand. It seems like the consumer side of things is really starting to drive some of the decision making for the production side. And I think, like, in my personal opinion, that's good. That is good for society. That's good for capitalism because it means that you and I are getting to make the choices that we want. We're not provided with just option A or option B decided by whatever large, giant corporate food company that is supplying the flavors there in New Jersey.
But there seems to be this little dance between if I start growing asparagus, I need to have consumers. And sometimes people don't know what to use these things for.
Yes.
So there's a couple of years there where they try to figure out that they can dance together, whatever.
Yes. Then you start adding in a lot of these ancillary elements. The culinary scene in St. John's is wonderful for that. There is certainly like barriers to that, especially for people that can't afford to go to a lot of restaurants, unfortunately.
Yep.
I don't have the answer for that one. But I do think that for a lot of us that are lucky enough to be able to go to restaurants, like we do it a lot of times to experience that new thing. And that allows us to broaden our horizons. And people in agriculture and farmers in general are like late adopters to a lot of things. They like other people to test it out first. And consumers, when it comes to food, are a lot of times the same way. Take some while to figure it out. And it's better if your friend down at the end of the table orders that strange dish. And I'm going to stick with like a steak and potatoes. But hey, you know, like pass me a bite of that.
That's right.
Kind of
thing.
So it takes a while. Like there is that dance, like you said. And it is trying to find that equilibrium between consumers and producers. But we forget that we just do that every single day, three times a day. I love agriculture because in a weird way, it's like somewhat subversive in this day and age. No one wants you to go into it or like, it's like a cool community because a lot of the young people in it, they're, you know.
It's an alternative lifestyle.
Yeah.
While we're a small province, we do have some very large operators and some very, very small ones. And as you say, self-provisioning is part of a lot of people's lives. It's always a challenge to figure out how can you create places where these people can meet together and talk and get to know each other and trust each other. And I guess in some ways the O'Brien Farm can serve as a locus for this area anyway.
That is absolutely one of the goals. Doing it in a space where a lot of people can participate. Hey, let's meet and greet and, you know, get our coffee and donut and like talk this over. But also get out. People forget that people that do that kind of work for a living, they're used to being outside. They need that communion.
Fall asleep inside.
They do. Too warm.
It would be great if
the dairy farmers in Newfoundland and Labrador would have some meetings here in one of the very first dairy farms. Would that be meaning symbolic, you know?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. That is the end goal, is to be a hub of innovation, a hub of human experience, yeah, and trying to expand communication between, yeah, all these parties.
I've heard you used to do a radio show that was called Fit to Eat.
Is that right? That's right.
Is that right?
Yeah.
This is crazy.
When I was in Mississippi.
Okay. Tell me about it.
So it was a nutritionist.
That's a Newfoundland expression. What are you doing with
fit to eat? Oh, I don't, you know, there's a lot of similarities. So Mississippi, it's geographically isolated in the fact that for a long time, it was probably just really, really difficult to get to. And once you got there, you probably thought to yourself, like, I might want to leave.
And it's hard to get out of.
It's hard to get out of, too. I mean, it's just like swampy and the forests are so thick. So there are similarities, right? Like, to a certain extent. And I think what sometimes is born out of that is this sense of folklore and self-deprecation and stuff like that. So Newfoundland has that in spades.
Yeah.
Mississippi has some of that, right?
This was a radio show in Mississippi that
when
you were with the museum?
Yes.
So what kind of things did it do?
It was a lot of just kind of happening in the city, what's going on in Mississippi, what's good, and then tying that into nutrition, tying that into local foods.
So there's the same kind of need for some communication around food there as well.
I think it's everywhere. I really do. The global food system has created a situation in which there's just an overwhelming amount of information, and it's just really hard for us to synthesize it. One of the ways that we can do it is by having these conversations, like meeting people, knowing that it is important because it does touch on all these other aspects of our life, our social networks, our cultural networks, our histories, and things like that.
As you're sitting here, maybe late afternoon sometimes, you ever wonder if the original O'Briens from 200 years ago were to wander and hear what they would say about what's happened to this? I mean, they would say it in Gaelic, so you wouldn't
know
what they're saying.
I think it's doing the same thing in the fact that it's not static, right? There's like an evolution that I think for most people in agriculture realize happens, or they hope it happens. And I think it is wonderful if this place was 15 generations of O'Briens farming it, but it isn't. And just like, there are things that change and all. One of the things that I know from what people have told me about Ali O'Brien was that he liked progress. He liked it in a sense that we don't need to overbuild. We don't need to turn this into a subdivision, but let's try new things. Like, let's try and evolve a little bit. Let's see what's out there. Let's test things out. When I look through the old records, and especially like the old books that are here, there is a sense of, we realize that we are going to have to change. Like, you know, here are folks that are like really searching. They're out there that are like looking for the commonalities and differences. They're looking to like understand their culture, preserve their culture, and yet at the same time, you know, have a like a Chinese grocer growing like bok choy up on the side of the hill too, right?
Yeah.
And I hope that the family would be happy that we were continuing a legacy of progress.
Thanks so much, Aaron. That's great.
Thanks, Adam.
See you.
Yeah.
Continuing a legacy of progress. That's a good way to end this interview, but it's still near the beginning for the new manifestation of the O'Brien Farm, 200 years and counting. Once you have a chance again, visit. It's a place to grow, a place to learn, a place to think. Long may it remain a beacon of country life in the midst of the city commotion.
So many great ideas through the dawn of time have been born out of people being told that that wouldn't work. Agriculture is one of the best ways to be able to experience a natural environment as much as you possibly can. And I love pulling stuff out of the garden and cooking it, but I also like a bag of chips every once in a while. There's so much interest right now in trying to solve some of these problems. And there are really, really smart people that, as far as I can tell, seem to want to work together.
This has been Fit to Eat, the Newfoundland Labrador Farm and Food Show. To listen to other episodes of this show or for more information, go to fittoeatnl.ca. The song for today's show was Erdi by Malian musician Ali Farkature. The theme music, Cluck Old Hen, was performed this week by Lotus White. This is a production of Kitchen Table Communications. I'm Ivan Emke. Join me again next time. I'll be right here. Happy trails.
Agriculture is an industry. Food is cultural.